There's often a pivotal moment in every film that decides the ultimate trajectory of the plot. The moment that decides which list this film is going to end up in on Netflix. Is it a drama or is it a tragedy? Will it be a film to pick us up or one to depress us? And the great filmmakers will keep us in suspense for as long as possible. We know what's going on over here. We also know what's going on over there. We see the pitfalls and obstacles that the story's characters have to overcome in order to be victorious. And we often see two conflicting plans that must collide before the outcome is known. That's where we're at in the story of Esther. Esther, our hero, a young Jewish woman, finds herself at the center of a national crisis, and only she can save her people. Will this story be a triumph of good over bad or a tale of tragedy and destruction? Only Esther, it seems, is able to influence that outcome. Or, as her uncle Mordecai put it, "And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this." You see, she's ended up as the queen of the Persian emperor, King Xerxes. We don't yet know if Xerxes is a good man or a bad man in this story. We do know he isn't a moral man. You see, Esther was chosen as queen from a group of the most beautiful young women of his empire in what can only be described as a sex competition. There's a man called Haman. He is undoubtedly the baddie in this story. He's conned the king to decree a day when all the Jews are to be killed. This hatred for the Jews comes from historical racial tension and a petty personal vendetta. He hates Mordecai, and that hatred has driven him to a desire for ethnic cleansing and public execution. But he's not happy to wait for Mordecai to die with the rest of the Jews. He wants that to happen now. So, egged on by his wife, he's put a plan into place by building a pole 75 foot tall on which he intends to impale his enemy Mordecai. Tomorrow, he'll ask the king's permission to rid his daily commute of this vile man. Meanwhile, unbeknown to Haman, Esther and Mordecai are putting a plan into place too. Esther has put herself into mortal danger by approaching the king without being summoned, something very much against royal protocol. But for the sake of her nation, her attitude was, "If I perish, I perish." But she finds favor, and the king promises to grant her whatever she wants. So she invites him and their enemy Haman to dinner. There, the king again promises to give her whatever she wants. But she decides to delay the big reveal, the fact that she is a Jew, and that the king's decree was her death sentence too, until tomorrow. So that day, Haman goes to bed a happy man, seemingly in favor with the queen, and the means to execute his enemy sorted. Tomorrow is a pivotal day. Tomorrow will decide the genre this story ends up in. Is it victory or is it tragedy? And that's where we've got to tonight. And at that point, we cut to the king's bedroom. And it's here we really start to see the influence of the most important person in any film. Someone unseen, yet whose influence is over all of it. The director. Look with me at verse 1. The king couldn't sleep. And despite Tim's suggestion last Sunday, I don't think it was because he'd eaten too much cheese. And it's no coincidence that the king couldn't sleep. Just as it was no coincidence that Esther was born beautiful. And it was no coincidence that Esther was the one the king chose. And it wasn't just a lucky day that she found the king in a good mood. You see, the timing of this royal insomnia is exquisite, and it was divinely purposed. It was God who was intervening. It was God who was directing every act and event. Every decision and response are in his control. Despite never being mentioned in the entire book, God's hand is evident in the whole story. And now, in the fine detail of the king's sleep pattern, we see God's finger, maybe gently poking King Xerxes as he lay in bed. The king couldn't sleep. When the king can't sleep, what does he do? Does he call for one of his many concubines to spend the night with him? Go for a walk in the beautiful royal gardens? Maybe call for one of the court's musicians to soothe him? Maybe switch on Netflix to watch the latest episode of his box set? No, verse 2, the king calls for some history books to be read to him. Now, we don't know if this was his idea of how to cure his insomnia, or if there was something in the back of his mind that was bothering him. But what he heard read didn't help him sleep. It only bothered him more. And it was no coincidence that of all the events of his reign, the one read to him that night was a story we've all already heard. God's finger turned the pages of the book to the story from just a short time earlier that we read in chapter 2, when a Jewish man named Mordecai reported and foiled an assassination plan against King Xerxes. But the king noticed there was one detail missing from the account. Look at verse 3. He says, "What honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? What did I do for him?" After a quick review of the papers, the king's attendants confirmed nothing. Nothing was done for Mordecai. Meanwhile, it was no coincidence that I suspect in his excitement of the day was to come, Haman was up early. He entered the king's court just as the king learned that Mordecai was not honored for his loyalty. Haman's intentions of being there was to ask the king's permission to kill Mordecai. His intentions would come to nothing because God had a different plan. Maybe the king heard someone outside when he said, "Who is it in the court?" "Haman," they said, "bring him in." You can imagine the skip in Haman's step as he went into the king. He'd been like a schoolboy on school trip day. And the king said to him in verse 6, "What should be done for the man the king delights to honor?" And it's at this point we really see Haman's heart. He is so far into himself that he immediately assumes the king can only be talking about him. So he lets his imagination run wild. He said, "I'm the king's prime minister. The queen seems to love having me around. There's only one thing left for me to do. I want to be king for a day." So he starts to pile it on. Give him a royal robe. Put him on a royal horse bearing a royal crest. Command one of the princes to lead this exalted man around the streets, proclaiming that the king honors him. Can this day get any better for Haman? Execute his enemy and dine with the royals and now even be treated like king for the day. His mind must have been racing, his adrenaline pumping. But his world was about to come crashing down around his ears. Verse 7. "Go at once, get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested, for Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate, do not neglect anything you have recommended." I reckon you probably could have knocked him over with a feather. The man he planned to publicly execute, he now had to publicly declare as honored by the king. The irony of this moment is one of great beauty. probably one of the greatest moments of drama in the entire Old Testament. We have no idea if he tried to say anything to the king. I doubt if anything would have come out, even if he'd tried. But through the most gritted of gritted teeth, he carried out the king's commands. Mordecai is collected from the palace gates. He's robed in a royal robe, placed on a royal horse, bearing a royal crest. But do you notice the one difference? Slight change from Haman's original suggestion. It wasn't a prince that led him through the streets. Haman himself had to do it. His humiliation was final. He rushed home, the passage said, with his head covered in grief. He recounted the day's events to his wife and his friends, the ones who had pushed him into this whole plan in the first place. Did they build him up and encourage him to see the plan through? No. It seems that they now too see that these day's events were not coincidental. Verse 13. Since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will surely come to ruin. They recognize that there's something bigger going on here. There's something about these Jews that's just trouble. There's something or someone who's got their back. You've started down a road that will only lead to one thing. Your ruin. Chapter 6, a great story, has one huge message running right through it. And that is, God is sovereign. God is sovereign. The Bible declares a God who is sovereign over the entire world. A God who is fulfilling his plans here on earth to build his kingdom. And chapter 6 shouts it out loud without even referencing God. He is directing every moment of what's going on. And we see that in two ways. Firstly, we see that God is sovereign and the kings are in his hands. King Xerxes, the most powerful man in the world, couldn't get to sleep. God kept him awake to ensure his plans would be fulfilled. The king was convinced he was in control. He was number one and what he said went. But he couldn't even control his own sleep pattern. And it's not just King Xerxes. Every king, prime minister, president, even dictator are in God's hands and are part of his plan to build his kingdom. Proverbs 21 says, in the Lord's hand, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels towards all who please him. God's purpose in appointing each of these world leaders is to do good for his people, to do good for us, his people. Paul, in his letter to the church in Rome, says the same. Let everyone be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except that which God has established. The appointment and the activity of all the world's leaders are ordained by God. He is sovereign over everything they do, every decree, every law, and every decision. Theresa May, President Trump, Il Jong-un, appointed by God and doing his business so that a stream of water is channeled towards all who please him. Sometimes hard to see that, isn't it? It must be really hard for the Christians of North Korea to see it. But the Bible does teach it. God will guide the hearts of the leaders of this world for the good of his people. So we can be encouraged because we, his people, are God's priority and he is in the business of building his kingdom. We don't always get his methods. We won't always get his methods. But we can be sure that he is God and he is good. So he can be trusted, even in the most apparent darkest of times. In King Xerxes, we see God directing events so that an execution was stopped for the good of God's people. The royal insomnia resulted in deliverance for Mordecai. He wasn't impaled on the pole. But these consequences of God's intervention in a king's life contrast with his involvement in the life of another foreign ruler. Fast forward a few hundred years, and Pilate, appointed by the Romans, is ruling over God's people. On this occasion, the ruler commanded another innocent man to be impaled on a pole, to be crucified. That man was Jesus Christ. But the Bible clearly teaches us that God was directing these events no less than he was the day Mordecai was spared. An innocent man executed as part of God's plan. Can this be so? Listen to a guy called Peter, one of Jesus' disciples. Fellow Israelites, listen to this. Jesus of Nazareth was a man accredited by God to you by miracles, wonders, and signs, which God did among you through him, as you yourselves know. This man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge, and you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. You see, this was God again directing the heart of a ruler to fulfill his ultimate kingdom building plan. And it's only because Jesus died that we can be in his kingdom. It is only because he was delivered by his Father into the hands of Pilate that we can know forgiveness of sins and eternal life with him. In the Lord's hands, the king's heart is a stream of water that he channels towards all who please him. And we are ultimately blessed because God's hand caused Pilate to crucify Jesus. And he is no less in control today. His plan is good and it will be fulfilled. The kings and the leaders are in his hands. We can trust him. And not only can we trust him because the kings are in his hands, we also see in this chapter that history itself is in his hands. And if history is in his hands, so are we. I wonder if Mordecai ever looked back at the day he saved the king's life and thought, what an ungrateful so-and-so. Not even a thank you letter. But again, the story shows us that God was directing events. And it is now, at this moment, that the king's heart is stirred to do something about his loyalty. God is in control of not just the king's heart, but all of history. His timing was perfect because this literally is his story. His will be done for the good of his people and the glory of his name. Again, some verses in Proverbs. A person's steps are directed by the Lord. How then can anyone understand their own way? And many are the plans in a person's heart, but it is the Lord's purpose that prevails. We can be encouraged that every step of our lives is directed by God. When we're tempted to question what's going on, we should remind ourselves that God is God and God is good. He only has plans to prosper us. His will be done. But to help us think that through, we need to grasp and understand what his will for us is. Verses often quoted from Romans 8 will help us with this. And we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. For those God foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his Son. God's will, God's purpose for us is to transform us to be more like Jesus. And God directs all our lives with that as his purpose. And that may sometimes mean we will face difficult times. Health issues, bereavement, redundancy, loneliness, exam pressures, sorry to bring that up, estrangements. We too will face joyful times, health, material prosperity, success in work or in exams. Let's pray that's the case. Close friendships. But we can in all those circumstances, whether difficult or joyful, trust God for what is happening because he is in the transformation business for this life and for the next. So friends, whether tomorrow is a day you're looking forward to or a day you're dreading, we can be comforted that God is lovingly transforming us to be like Jesus, both in the good times and in the shadow of suffering. And so we are called to respond with hearts that serve him and seek to willingly be transformed. Yes, life can sometimes be rubbish. The Bible doesn't pretend that isn't the case. Esther and Mordecai could certainly testify to that. Life hurts, but God is always using whatever he has ordained to transform us. And Mordecai helps us think through that brilliantly. He is an example of faithfulness and humility. And we are called to be like that too. He's the absolute opposite to Haman. Mordecai is about self-forgetfulness, not self-importance. Haman is rushing around getting his will done. He has plans and he is all about them. He is self-obsessed. We can all be like that, can't we? We want our way to be done. But Mordecai spent his days serving the king at the gate, palace gate. When the assassination plot was discovered, he reported it. There were no thanks, no recognition. He could have thrown his toys out of the pram there and then. He didn't. He continued to serve. When recognition finally came, Mordecai didn't then develop a sense of self-importance. Do you see what he did in verse 12? It's a very simple verse, but it's a beautiful one. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate. No fuss, no pride. He returned to the king's gate to serve there. The circumstances of life, whether trials or triumphs, were not what shaped him. His service to the king was his priority. And we must be the same. We are not here to serve ourselves. We are here to serve the king, Jesus Christ. And what does that mean for us as a church? We're on the brink of making a decision that will shape the future of our church for generations to come. How should we approach this decision? Well, the obvious answer is prayerfully. But in prayer, we should also remember that God has got this. He is in control. His purposes will be fulfilled. His people will be saved. So, whatever happens on Tuesday, whether the vote is as we voted or otherwise, like Mordecai, we should respond with humility. Tuesday is not about us or our ministries. It's not even about Kensington Baptist Church. It's about God's kingdom. So whatever the outcome on Tuesday, we must remain humble, loving one another. Mordecai's behavior in response to his lack of or over-the-top recognition was identical. Humble service. God wants to conform us into the image of his son. He wants us all to be like Jesus. Let's find out what happens next. At the moment that Haman's wife warned him of his impending failure, there was a knock on the door. The king's servants here to collect him for dinner. We don't know if Haman went gladly, whether he saw it as an opportunity to escape the disastrous day he'd had and dine with Esther and Xerxes. At least he still seemed to be in favor with them. Or if his heart sank as he realized he'd have to put on a brave face and to pretend he was enjoying himself. But he did go. And maybe things started to look up for Haman. Maybe his spirits were lifted as he tasted the sweetest food and drank the finest wine with the most powerful man in the world and his beautiful queen. Perhaps life isn't too bad after all. And then as they dined, the king asked Esther the question for the third time. You see in verse 2 there. Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. And this time, Esther answers. And it wasn't what the king was expecting. All I ask for, Xerxes, is my life and those of my people. You see, we've been sold to be destroyed, wiped off this earth. That's why I've bothered you with all this. If it was only a matter of being sold into slavery, I would have stayed quiet. But this is serious. This is literally a matter of life and death. This is a matter of my life and my death. Xerxes was perplexed. How can this be? Who is responsible for this? Who would dare to order the death of my queen? And you can imagine this moment. This is box office magic. As Esther's gaze shifted from her husband king across the room towards Haman as she uttered the accusing words, an adversary and an enemy, this vile Haman. Whatever Haman was feeling before, we have no doubt now. He is terrified. The queen has just told the king that Haman has conned him into signing her death warrant. The king is livid. He slams down his wine glass and walks out. Haman already knew his fate. It seemed his bad day was about to become his last day. He could only see one last hope, one last roll of the dice. He begged the queen for his life. It seems, however, he did it a little too enthusiastically, because when the king returned, what he saw was Esther lying on the couch and Haman falling onto her. The king, if he was livid before, is going to a new level. Standing only inches from his face, he says, "Will you even molest the queen while I'm in the house?" The spit from his anger covered his face. One of the king's eunuchs, getting what was going on, saw fit to give the king some information. A pole reaching to a height of 50 cubits stands by Haman's house. He had it set up for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. "Impale him on it," was the king's simple command. So a day that started with Haman too excited to sleep and Mordecai due to be executed ended with Mordecai honored like royalty and Haman impaled on his own pole. If chapter 6 teaches us about God's sovereignty, I think chapter 7 teaches us that whilst God is sovereign, we must be his active people. Yes, God is directing every moment of this trying time. His care for his people is demonstrated in the way every minute detail is orchestrated to rescue Mordecai and stop Haman. He is sovereign, but in his sovereignty, he uses his people. Esther and Mordecai spent time in prayer and fasting. We saw that last week. And this week we see Esther step out and act. Last week we saw how she wisely waited to seek the king's help in rescuing her people. This week we see her take the plunge. It was brave, it was bold, and it was selfless. You see, yeah, the king seemed pleased with her yesterday, but who knows what news he'd received from one of the provinces overnight. Maybe another nation was rebelling against him. Maybe he had a particular dislike for all foreign nations at that point. Esther didn't know. Maybe Haman had clocked what was happening and taken the opportunity to have a quiet word in his ear and get the king on his side. We certainly saw in his treatment of Vashti that this king can be impulsive and clinical. But Esther was brave, bold, and selfless for the sake of God's chosen people. And we too are called to be brave, bold, and selfless for the sake of God's kingdom. See, God has placed each one of us where we are for such a time as this. God has placed each colleague, neighbor, schoolmate, and family member in our lives for such a time as this. Will we be brave and declare our devotion to Jesus? Will we disclose that we belong to his people? Will we be bold and declare to them that they too can know life through the death and resurrection of Jesus? Will we be selfless and put our own comfort, our own popularity, our own careers, even our own lives on the line for the sake of God's kingdom purposes being fulfilled? Will we, with Esther, say, if I perish, I perish? Jesus did. For the sake of God's people, he went willingly to his death. And we're called to take up our cross and follow him, wherever that may take us. And God has also placed each of us in this church for such a time as this. He is calling us to be brave and bold and selfless as we think through how we approach the church members' meeting on Tuesday. To be willing to lose contact with people we love, maybe. Maybe to lose ministries we love. Or maybe just to disagree well. But we do it knowing this. We act knowing this. That God is sovereign. He is sovereign over every minute of our lives. He is sovereign over those who may target us with troubles. He is sovereign over the rulers of the nations. He is sovereign over the leaders and members of Kensington Baptist Church. No one does anything unless God allows it. And who knows? God may use little old you and me to do mighty, mighty things. Esther was a no one, catapulted into a place where only she could do his work. She did it with boldness, bravery, and selflessness. Maybe you are where you are because only you can do his work in your workplace, in your community. Maybe you're the one he's calling to step out, to be bold, to be brave, to be selfless. You see, God doesn't do things as we would. God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. So trust in him. And even when comforts are few and tears are great, we can hope in the ever new mercies of a God who has our lives in his hands and our good in his plans.